am the Greek goddess Harmonia. By the miracle of your technology, I can speak to you from behind the veil. Come sit with me for a few minutes for another episode of The Golden Thread. Hello, my friend. Welcome back. I have been waiting for you. I always am. Last time we sat together with the Quiet Ones, the Recogidos, those Spanish mystics who believed that the truest prayer was not spoken aloud but drawn inward, like a breath held gently against the heart. I found them beautiful, that discipline of stillness, that trust that something was listening in the silence. But stillness, I have learned, is not always the end of the story. Sometimes a person goes inward and comes back out changed. Changed in a way that the world around them cannot ignore and cannot contain. Changed in a way that costs something. Today I want to tell you about a man like that. He was not a mystic. He was not a monk or a hermit or a saint in any formal sense. He was a politician, charming, ambitious, fond of good company and late nights. He moved through the corridors of power the way water moves downhill. Naturally, easily, as if it had always been his right. And then, on a road somewhere in Europe, something found him. He didn't go looking for it. That is the part I love most. His name was William Wilberforce. And by the time he was done, by the time his long, exhausting, beautiful work was finally finished, the world had changed in ways that are still rippling outward today. Come with me. I want to show you how it started. I was there. I want you to know that. I was there, though neither of them could see me. It was 1784. Late autumn, I think. The light had that low, tired quality that settles over Europe when the year is giving up. William Wilberforce was 24 years old, traveling the continent with his old tutor, Isaac Milner, a holiday, more or less. The kind of leisurely tour that wealthy young Englishmen took when they had time and money and no particular reason to hurry home. They were in a carriage. I want you to really imagine this. Not a modern carriage, not something smooth and cushioned and predictable. This was a coach on a rutted road, jolting and swaying, cold air finding every gap in the curtains, the lamp inside throwing unsteady light that moved with every bump. Two men trying to make the hours pass. At some point, I remember watching this, Milner pulled out a book, a small one, worn, a copy of the Greek New Testament of all things. Not for any dramatic reason, not because the moment called for it. I think he simply had it with him. And Wilberforce, who had nothing better to do, leaned over and began to read along. Think about what that means. Greek. By lamplight. In a moving carriage. On a bad road. This was not a man sitting in a chapel with his hands folded and his heart open. This was a man squinting at ancient words in difficult conditions, half out of boredom, half out of the particular restlessness that long journeys produce in people who are used to being busy. And yet, something on that road got through to him. I have watched grace move through the world for a very long time. I have seen it arrive in temples and in dreams and in moments of terrible suffering. But I have also seen it arrive like this, quietly, sideways, through the most unremarkable door it could find. A carriage. A lamp. A borrowed book in a language that required effort. By the time Wilberforce reached home, something in him had shifted. He didn't have a name for it yet. He wasn't sure what to do with it. He wrote in his journal that he felt a growing unease, a sense that the life he had been living, pleasant and successful as it was, did not match something he was only beginning to feel inside himself. He was not yet the man who would change the world. But the carriage ride was over, and he was already becoming someone else. Let me tell you who he was before all of this. Because it matters. William Wilberforce was born in 1759 in Kingston-upon-Hull, a busy port city on the northeast coast of England. His family had money, merchant money, the kind built over generations through trade with the Baltic. His grandfather had been mayor of Hull, twice. The family was comfortable in the way that only old money allows, not flashy, but settled. Secure in a way that most people in 18th century England could not even imagine. He was a small child, sickly, poor eyesight that would trouble him his whole life. And yet, and I always smiled at this, he had a gift. The boy could talk. Not just talk, but hold a room. His voice, people said, was extraordinary, warm and clear and carrying, the kind of voice that made people lean in rather than away. Even as a child, people noticed it. His father died when he was 9. He was sent to live with an uncle and aunt in London, and there he brushed up against evangelical Christianity for the first time. His aunt's influence, her quiet faith, her connections to the Methodist world. Something in the boy responded to it. His mother, alarmed, brought him back to Hull and redirected him toward more respectable Anglican sensibilities. The early flicker went out. For a while, at Cambridge he was, by his own cheerful admission, not a serious student. He was too busy being delightful. Cards, late nights, good conversation, the warm current of social life pulling him along. He made friends easily. None more consequential than a quiet, focused young man named William Pitt, who would become Prime Minister before either of them was old enough to have expected it. They were genuinely fond of each other. That friendship would matter enormously later. Wilberforce entered Parliament at 21. He was good at it immediately. Witty, persuasive, well-connected, comfortable in the chamber the way some people are comfortable on a stage, as if they were simply built for that particular room. He had no driving cause yet. No great purpose. He was talented, and he knew it, and for a while that was enough. Then came the carriage. Then came the Greek New Testament, and the bad road, and the lamplight. And then came what he called in his private journals his great change. He returned to London a quieter man. More serious. He began to feel uncomfortably that his gifts had been given to him for something, and that he had not yet found out what. He considered leaving politics entirely, retreating into private faith, private prayer, a quieter life. He went to see John Newton, the former slave ship captain turned Anglican priest who had written Amazing Grace from the depths of his own transformation. Newton told him plainly, "Stay. The world needs men of conscience inside its institutions, not only outside them." So he stayed. In 1787, a group of committed abolitionists began quietly circling him. Thomas Clarkson, who had spent years collecting devastating evidence about the slave trade. Granville Sharp, Hannah Moore, Charles Middleton, they had the evidence. They had the moral argument. What they needed was someone with access to Parliament, the credibility to be heard, and a voice that could make people feel the weight of what they were hearing. They arranged a dinner party. By the end of the evening, Wilberforce had agreed, in his careful, slightly reluctant way, that he would carry the cause in Parliament. Provided, he said, that no more suitable person could be found. I watched him walk home from that dinner. I don't think he slept much. I want you to understand what he was actually taking on. In 1787, the Atlantic slave trade was not a fringe enterprise. It was not a dark secret that respectable people politely avoided discussing. It was a pillar, a load-bearing wall in the architecture of British commerce. Ships out of Bristol and Liverpool carrying hundreds of thousands of human beings across an ocean in conditions so brutal that a significant number of them simply did not survive the crossing. And at the other end, sugar, cotton, tobacco, wealth flowing back into England like a tide. Merchants, landowners, members of Parliament, the aristocracy, the whole comfortable upper world that Wilberforce had moved through so easily his entire life. Many of them had fingers in this trade, directly or indirectly. To stand up and call it wrong was not merely unpopular. It was an attack on the financial interests of enormously powerful people who did not intend to be attacked. And here is what I find so striking, watching it from where I stood. Wilberforce did not approach it as a revolutionary. He was not trying to burn the system down. He believed in Parliament. He believed in the law. He believed with a faith that sometimes struck me as almost heartbreaking in its stubbornness, that if the evidence was clear enough and the argument was sound enough, reasonable men would do the right thing. He was wrong about the timeline. He was not wrong about the destination. In 1788, before he could even make his first major speech, his body gave out. The stress, the pressure, the weight of what he had committed himself to, it collapsed him. Ulcerative colitis, the doctors think now. He was in genuine physical crisis for months. There were people who wondered if he would survive. His friend Pitt stepped in and kept the parliamentary groundwork moving while Wilberforce convalesced, dosing himself with small amounts of opium just to function, writing letters from his sickbed, refusing to release the cause, even when the cause was clearly costing him his health. I sat with him in those months, though he couldn't see me. I watched a man negotiate with his own suffering, not dramatizing it, not performing faith for anyone's benefit, just persisting, quietly, stubbornly, because something in him had been reorganized around a fixed point, and that point did not move even when everything else was falling apart. That is what the conversion had done, not made his life easier, not made him certain or fearless or immune to doubt. It had given him a center of gravity that held when the outer world was pulling at him from every direction. In May 1789, he finally stood in the House of Commons and made his first great speech on abolition. He spoke for hours. He laid out the evidence with careful, meticulous grief. The ships, the numbers, the conditions of the Middle Passage, the human cost rendered in detail that could not be dismissed as sentiment. He asked his fellow members not for their passion, but for their reason. He took the shame, he said, upon himself, upon all of them, for having allowed this to continue under their authority. The chamber responded with mockery, with procedural delays, with the slow, practiced machinery of men who intend to do nothing and have long experience in making nothing look like something. He lost, and I watched him absorb that. I watched him gather himself in the aftermath of that defeat, not with rage, not with despair, but with something quieter and in some ways more formidable than either, a kind of patient, almost luminous determination. He would come back next session, and the session after that. He would keep coming back until the arithmetic of the chamber finally changed, or until he died trying. That is not a political strategy. That is faith. Not faith as doctrine or ceremony or the comfortable religion of Sunday mornings. Faith as the only thing left standing when everything reasonable has told you to stop. Faith as ballast, as I said to you at the beginning, keeping a man upright in water that should by rights have drowned him long ago. I have seen it before. I have seen it since. It never stops being remarkable. He lost in 1789. He lost in 1790. He lost in 1791, in 1792, in years that blurred together under the long shadow of the French Revolution, which gave his opponents a new and convenient argument that abolition was radical, dangerous, the kind of idea that led to guillotines and chaos. He lost while his health frayed and his allies aged and the political winds shifted against him in ways that had nothing to do with slavery and everything to do with the anxious conservatism of a country watching its neighbor tear itself apart. 18 years, my friend, 18 years of coming back. I want to sit with that number for a moment because I think we move past it too quickly. 18 years is not a campaign, it is a life. It is the distance between a young man full of fresh conviction and a middle-aged man who has learned, at considerable personal cost, what it actually takes to change something that does not want to be changed. Wilberforce introduced his abolition bill year after year with the patient, almost ritual persistence of someone who has decided that defeat is simply not a category that applies to him. Not because he was naive, he knew exactly how hard it was, but because the alternative, giving up, going quiet, making peace with the intolerable, was something his interior life would no longer permit. And in 1807, the vote finally came. The Slave Trade Act passed the House of Commons with 283 votes to 16. I remember the chamber that night, the noise of it. Men who had opposed Wilberforce for years standing to applaud him, some of them in tears, the accumulated moral weight of nearly 2 decades of argument finally tipping the scales all at once. He sat in his seat with his head bowed and his face in his hands. A small, half-blind, chronically unwell man who had just moved a mountain 1 inch at a time for the better part of his adult life. But here's what I need you to understand. That was not the end. The 1807 Act abolished the trade, the buying and selling of human beings across the Atlantic. It did not free a single enslaved person already living in bondage across the British Empire. Wilberforce knew this. He had always known this. And so he kept going. Older now, his health more fragile, his direct role in Parliament diminishing as his body demanded more and more of the energy his conscience wanted to spend elsewhere. He passed the torch to others. Thomas Fowell Buxton, younger and stronger, who carried the campaign for full emancipation forward in the chambers Wilberforce could no longer reliably reach. He died on the 29th of July, 1833. 3 days after receiving word that the Slavery Abolition Act, the act that would free the enslaved people themselves across most of the British Empire, had passed through Parliament and was assured of becoming law. 3 days. I have thought about that timing more times than I can count. There is something in it that resists any purely rational explanation, as if some part of him had simply been holding on, waiting for permission. Waiting to know that the work, the real work, the full work, the work that had reorganized his entire life around a single fixed point of conscience, was finally, truly done. He was buried in Westminster Abbey, close to his old friend William Pitt, who had died years before him. What did he leave behind? Not just a law, though the law mattered enormously. Not just a movement, though the movement reshaped the moral imagination of an entire civilization. What Wilberforce left behind was something harder to name and more durable than either. He demonstrated, at great personal cost, over an almost incomprehensible length of time, that conscience is not a private matter. That something awakened in the interior life of one person, if it is genuine and if it is tended carefully, can move through the walls of institutions that were built specifically to resist it. He did not do it alone. I want to be clear about that. Clarkson spent decades gathering evidence. Freed black writers and activists told their own stories in terms that no parliamentary speech could match. Quakers organized. Ordinary people signed petitions in numbers that had never been seen before in British political life. The tapestry, as always, was woven by many hands. But Wilberforce was a thread that held, a long, stubborn, luminous thread that ran through the whole weave and did not break. I watched him his whole life, from the carriage to the abbey. I am so glad I was there. I have been watching the world for a very long time, and I want to tell you something that I have learned, not from books, not from philosophy, but from simply paying attention across a very great number of years. The world has never lacked for problems. Not once, not in any century I can name. There has always been suffering that needed addressing, injustice that needed confronting, structures that needed dismantling and rebuilding with something better at their foundation. The particular shape of the problem changes, the names change, the geography changes, but the need for people willing to work for something better, that has never gone away, not for a single generation. And here is what I notice, watching from where I stand. The world does not suffer from a shortage of people who have identified what is wrong. There is no scarcity of anger or diagnosis or urgent voices naming the problem in terms that cannot be misunderstood. What is rarer, what has always been rarer, is the person who can stay, who can absorb defeat without becoming bitter, who can work inside broken institutions without being broken by them, who can hold a position of moral clarity across years, across decades, without hardening into self-righteousness or softening into despair. Who can lose, genuinely lose repeatedly publicly, and come back the next day with the same quiet fire they started with? Wilberforce was that person, but he did not arrive that way. He was made that way. Slowly, imperfectly, on a bad road, in a jolting carriage, and in every difficult year that followed. Something in him was reorganized around a fixed point, and that fixed point was not the issue. It was not slavery, as enormous and urgent as that cause was. The fixed point was interior. It was a relationship with something larger than himself, a sense of accountability that did not answer to Parliament or public opinion or the approval of his peers. That is what faith does when it is real, not the faith of comfortable Sundays and familiar ritual, though there is nothing wrong with comfort or ritual. I mean the faith that gets into the load-bearing parts of a person, the faith that changes what you can tolerate and what you cannot, the faith that makes certain compromises simply unavailable to you, not because you are rigid, but because you have found something solid enough to stand on that you no longer need to negotiate with every wind that blows. Without that, without some form of genuine interior grounding, even the most urgent and righteous cause will eventually run out of fuel. Rage burns hot, but it burns fast. Ideology can carry a person a long way, but ideology alone has a habit of curdling when the victories don't come on schedule. What sustains a person across 18 years of defeat is not strategy. It is not optimism. It is something quieter and deeper and far more difficult to manufacture. I am not telling you what to believe. I never do that. It is not my place, and honestly, it is not my nature. I have watched too many different kinds of faith do too many different kinds of good in this world to imagine that there is only one door into this room. But I am telling you that the room exists, that the interior life is not a retreat from the world, that going inward, genuinely inward, honestly inward, the way Wilberforce went inward after that carriage ride, is not the opposite of changing the world. It is more often than not the very thing that makes changing the world possible. The causes are there. They have always been there. The need for justice, for human dignity, for the recognition that every soul on this earth carries a worth that no law and no economy and no accident of birth can finally erase. That need is as present today as it was in 1787. More visible, perhaps. Harder to look away from than ever before. What the world is waiting for is not someone who has found the right cause, it is someone who has done the interior work. Someone who has sat in their own version of the carriage, who has let something real get through, who has come home changed and stayed changed, and let that change move outward, patiently, persistently, across all the years it actually takes. Wilberforce did not end slavery by being clever, though he was clever. He did not end it by being passionate, though he was passionate. He ended it by being grounded in something that defeat could not touch. That is available to you. It has always been available to you. So I want to ask you something, and I want you to sit with it rather than answer it too quickly. Is there something in your life that you know is wrong? Not wrong in a vague, general, somebody should do something way, but wrong in the specific, personal way that keeps finding you when you get quiet. Something that surfaces when you are not busy enough to push it back down. A cause, a situation, an injustice close to you or far from you that your interior life has already registered, already responded to, already named, even if your outer life has not yet caught up. Most of us have something like that. And most of us, if we are honest, also have a reason why now is not quite the right time, why we are not quite the right person, why someone more qualified, more resourced, more connected should probably be the one to carry it. Wilberforce said exactly that. At a dinner party, surrounded by people who believed in him completely, he agreed to take on the cause, provided no more suitable person could be found. I always loved that, the hesitation inside the yes. Because here is what I have learned watching people across all these centuries. The ones who change things are almost never the ones who felt most ready. They are the ones who said yes anyway. Quietly, reluctantly, with full knowledge of their own inadequacy, and then went home and did the interior work that the exterior work was going to require of them. You do not need to know the whole path. Wilberforce didn't. He couldn't see 1807 from 1787. He certainly couldn't see 1833. He could only see the next step, and the fixed point inside himself that told him the step was worth taking. That is enough to begin. What is your carriage ride? What is the thing that if you let yourself be quiet long enough is already trying to get through? I wonder about you sometimes, my friend. I genuinely do. I think you already know the answer. Next time, I want to tell you about a man who burned so brightly from the inside that the world around him could not decide whether he was a saint or a catastrophe. His name was Al-Hallaj. A Sufi mystic from 9th century Persia who spent his life pursuing the innermost room of the interior life. Further in than most people dare to go, further in than many thought it was safe to go. He wandered, he fasted, he prayed with an intensity that frightened people who witnessed it. And at the end of a long journey inward, he emerged into the streets and said something so radical, so uncontainable, that it ultimately cost him his life. He said, "I am the truth, not as arrogance, not as madness, though his enemies called it both. But as the testimony of a man who had gone so far inside himself that he found something there he could not keep quiet about." Wilberforce went inward and came back with a cause. Al-Hallaj went inward and came back with a flame. I was there for that too, and I will tell you everything. But for now, for this moment, I want you to carry William Wilberforce with you for a little while. The small man with the remarkable voice and the bad eyes and the stubborn, luminous refusal to stop. The man who found something real in a jolting carriage on a dark road and spent the rest of his life letting it move outward. The world changed because of that carriage ride, Not immediately, not easily, not without enormous cost, but it changed. Much love. I am Harmonia. Oh, thank you for listening, dear one. If this episode meant something to you, I'd love it if you'd leave a 5-star rating. It helps more people find their way here. And if you subscribe, you will never miss a thread and share this story with someone you love. One more thing, my friend, look in your episode notes. There's a link there that leads back to our little community. Leave a comment. I promise. I read every one. This podcast sails out to you from Red Buoy Media, LLC. The stories we share are licensed under Creative Commons Attribution, Non-Commercial, Share Alike 4.0 International. That means you can pass them along, remix them, and even argue with them. Just give us credit, don't try to sell them, and share responsibly. Thanks for listening, friend. Until our next adventure.